Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, February 8th, 2016. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll profile rainforest yoga. We'll learn how you can send a Pride Chorus singing telegram for Valentine's Day. Cecilia Rendon will be here to highlight energy-efficient homes, and we'll talk with Dr. Vincent Falidi and Sea Alaska Heritage Institute trustee Patrick Anderson about the lifelong effects of adverse childhood experiences and their presentation on Tuesday. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. Currently 38 degrees at the Juno Airport, 37 in Gustavus and Hoonah.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Canadian government has agreed to talk about settling a lawsuit alleging abuses and cultural loss of students at residential schools in Newfoundland and Labrador. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, about 1,200 Aboriginal people were excluded from the 2008 government apology and settlement in connection with residential schools across the rest of Canada.
Lawyers and former students of the schools in Newfoundland and Labrador say it's a surprise development, but a welcome one. They've been seeking tens of millions of dollars in compensation. Many were devastated when they found out they were left out of the apology and compensation settlement made nearly a decade ago. Federal government lawyers have said Ottawa was not responsible for schools that opened before the province of Newfoundland and Labrador joined the rest of Canada in 1949. But lawyers for former students say after 1949, the federal government had the same legal responsibility to Aboriginal students in the province as elsewhere in Canada. The trial over the lawsuit was adjourned recently so lawyers for both sides could try to negotiate a settlement. One former residential school student in Newfoundland, Cindy Dwyer, says after fighting for so long, the change came as a big surprise.
I'm just so happy that finally this may be going somewhere and we may get a settlement within 29 days. It's surreal.
One defense lawyer says the change in government in Ottawa also led to a dramatic change in attitude, and the new government of Liberal Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has shown sensitivity to First Nations, Inuit, and Métis issues. A deadline for a settlement has been set for the end of the month. If the talks fail, the trial will resume. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The lack of access to high-speed internet remains a problem on tribal lands across the country, including in the Dakotas. Brandon Campbell has more.
A new report from the Federal Watchdog Government Accountability Office highlights serious barriers to setting up fast and reliable internet connections in those areas. Mark Goldstein headed up the report for the GAO. His group interviewed 21 tribes, including the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe of North and South Dakota. They found that high-speed internet was available to only 37% of homes in tribal areas, compared with 92% in most urban areas.
The internet and broadband is a much more important tool because of access for healthcare, for emergency services, for economic interests. There's a whole range of issues for which Americans need to access the internet.
The report has several recommendations, including a push for better data collection and more coordination from the government agencies in charge of expanding internet access to tribal lands. I'm Brandon Campbell, reporting.
The fastest land mammal in North America is again running free in north-central Washington after a long absence. The Colville Confederated Tribes recently relocated 52 antelope onto their reservation. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has more.
Indiscriminate hunting and habitat loss a century ago nearly wiped out pronghorn populations in the American West. They've bounced back most everywhere except in Washington State. In 2011, the Yakima Nation and a sportsman's group relocated nearly 100 pronghorn antelope onto tribal lands south of Toppenish. Now the Colville Confederated Tribes are getting in the act.
We're just really excited and we're going to keep our fingers crossed that they do well.
Randy Friedlander is the Colville Tribe's Fish and Wildlife Director.
What seems to resonate is the idea of bringing back a species that's been lost for some time. It's kind of like a restoration effort. And that fits really well within our tribe.
Friedlander says the reintroduced pronghorns were captured in northern Nevada. If the population takes hold, he says the tribe may consider allowing some hunting. For National Native News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia, Washington.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who had their day one at knva.org.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon here on Monday, February 8th, 2016. It's about 6 minutes after the hour. Scott Burton, your host, and I've been joined in the studio now by Larae Jones. She's the Assistant Treasurer, and Margaret Vrolik. She is on the fundraising committee of PFLAG and the Juneau Pride Course. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thanks very much. It's fun being here.
It's so nice to see you both. Can you tell us a little bit about PFLAG and the Juneau Pride Course?
PFLAG stands for Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. So I joined the chorus many, many years ago. Now less than 10, but more than 7, somewhere around in there. And so I'm one of the friends, and I've just enjoyed immensely the singing with them, and I did travel with them the last time we went to Denver for the gala festival. And that was, this year's another gala festival, and that's what we're raising money for. So,
okay, and that was the voice of Margaret. So we're here to talk about singing Valentines, among other things, right, Larae? And
yes.
This is going to help create money for the gala festival.
That's right. We are both part of a small group of the chorus, the ensemble, that we call ourselves the Pitch Hitters. And we are doing Singing Valentines all day and evening on Friday. So people can basically hire us to come sing two songs at an office or a home or wherever in the borough here, or by phone, which, and one year we Skyped to Kenya and sang over the phone. So in person, you get your choice of two songs and a card, and by phone, we just do one song. But in person, it's $75, and by phone, it's $35, and we just have a great, it's a really fun day going around, especially to the offices singing.
I bet. How many members are in the Pitch Hitters?
The Pitch Hitters this year there's 9 of us. And they are Leslie Wood, Mary Graham, Rachel Zond, Jackie Farnsworth, May Rose Huntley, Bobby Mitchell, April McVeigh, Margaret Vrolik, and myself, Larae Jones.
It's a great crew. And will you share the songs you're going to sing now, or should we keep that as a surprise?
No, because people get to choose which ones they want. So we're going to sing My Romance, Till There Was You, which is, from The Music Man, The Rose, which is a really gorgeous ballad, Till the Stars Fall from the Sky, which is just, I'm going to love you until then. It's a beautiful song. And Candle on the Water, which is an old Helen Reddy song that was from one of her movies, and I don't remember which one right off the top of my head. But anyway, great selection of love songs, and we're looking forward to singing them for somebody.
Absolutely. So this is all day Friday.
All day Friday.
And if somebody wants to contact you to order one of these singing Valentines, how should they do that?
To order, you should text 907-209-7757 or email jfin@gci.net by Thursday, so we can get the schedule organized. Solidified, yeah.
Sounds good. Listeners, we'll repeat that here in a couple minutes, so get your pens ready. This sounds like fun. What do you both like most about the Juno Pride Chorus?
Getting together. We get together once a week, starting in the fall, and then we have our concert in the spring. And then those who go, like, to Denver will be meeting then. But really, after the concert, it is the end of our,
regular season.
Yeah. And then we usually have a gathering maybe a month or two afterwards, sometimes before the next season starts, to watch the video of our performance so that we can critique ourselves, et cetera. So.
This year,
Mary?
If anybody wants to know, the concert is going to be April 30th, so you can mark your calendars early. There'll certainly be more advertising before then.
Yeah, you'll come back in on the show, I hope, and tell us about that.
Yeah.
And how about you, Lorraine? What do you like most about the group?
It's the camaraderie. It's just a wonderful group of supportive women, and we support each other, and it's just uplifting to get to go and singing. There's a bunch of fun songs that we're getting ready for the concert. So,
if somebody wanted to get involved with PFLAG and or the Juno Pride Chorus, how could they do that, and in what capacity?
We're always picking up more singers. And with PFLAG itself, there's just a myriad of things to do. Certainly the fundraising committee, we're always looking for people to help us raise money for whatever happens to be on the plate. Donate items to our silent auction, which we'll have along with the concert, and should get a hold of, any one of us could, or come to the Lutheran Church downtown on Tuesday evening at 5:30.
I think it probably goes without saying, but why is it important to have an organization like PFLAG?
Well, for me, since I have discovered that I'm neither lesbian nor gay, there was a point in my life where I was questioning, quote, my thoughts, what is the value of me separate from being a wife, or separate from men, and separate from children? Is there any value in me? And I kind of asked that to the universe, and I was also looking for a place to sing, and lo and behold, I end up in the Pride Chorus. And there are so many wonderful women who contribute so much to our society, and they neither have a man in their life, and they may not have children in their lives either, but there's still value there. And so that's what it did for me.
All right.
Well, and I've known quite a few of the women in the chorus for 30 years that I've been in Juno. And I always said if I had enough time, and I would love to join a chorus, this is the one I would want to join. And so 4 years ago, my schedule lightened up enough that I could take on something else. And I've been singing with them ever since. I just love it. It's just great.
Thank you. Thoughtful answers. Singing Valentine's this Friday,
all day.
Send all a group of nine, was it, Lorraine?
Yes, a group of nine.
Enthusiastic singers.
Oh, yes. A lot of fun.
To your office, to the location of your choice within the borough.
Right.
It's a pretty big borough.
It is. So we'd like to maybe only make one long trip out the road and hit a bunch of places, but we'll put the full gas tank and we'll go wherever we need to go. So looking forward to it.
And remind us how one can order this again, please.
Text to 907-209-7757 or email jfin@gci.net.
Okay.
So we're looking forward to having a lot of fun and raising lots of money for our trip to Denver this summer.
Absolutely. Lorraine Jones, Margaret Vrolik, thank you so much for coming on the show. Is there anything else either of you would like to add?
No, just think about coming to our concert, too. I think you'd enjoy it. It's always a fun event. And thanks so much for having us.
Great. Thanks. Have fun on Friday.
Yeah, we will.
Thank you. We will.
Comes from Alaska Robotics, featuring comic authors Kate Beaton, Ryan North, Kazuo Kibuishi, and Raina Telgemeier in Juneau this April for a mini-comic convention and artist camp. Registration information at minicon.alaskarobotics.com.
Writers, it's time to submit to the March edition of Writers Showcase. Short stories and creative nonfiction should be between 5 and 15 minutes long when read aloud and can be on the theme of your choice. Go to 360north.org to watch past episodes and for more information. Submissions and questions should be sent to arts at ktoo.org by midnight on February 8th. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, February 8th, 2016. It's about 20 minutes after the hour. Scott Burton, your host. Joining me now in the studio is Cecilia Rendon. She's here to highlight Energy Efficient Homes of Alaska. She's presenting tomorrow at the Innovation Summit at 3 p.m. About all things efficient homes of various sizes. Welcome to the show, Cecilia.
Thanks, Scott. Happy to be here. I'm attending the University of Alaska School of Management, and thanks to their generosity, they sponsor me to participate in the summit along with Northern Bank. And my longtime dream was to move to Alaska, but I wanted to bring something of true value that would measure up to Alaskans' resilience and innovation. And I invested a lot of time and money and effort to visiting different manufacturers of prefabs, and nobody ever measure up to the quality of Cocoon Homes, which is the dealer that I represent. They are manufactured in the United States, and what's most unique about it is that they are made of soy, as in green, shiny soybeans. There is no formaldehyde. They're non-toxic. And also what is so important about Cocoon Homes is that they are framed with 20-gauge steel, recycled steel, which we recycle an average of 7 cars per home for the framing.
Okay. Tell us about the different sizes. What's the smallest home that you all make, and what's the biggest?
Well, they are custom from 6,000 square feet to we're part of the tiny home movement, which is you could get it on a foundation or you can get it on a trailer, and that's 147 square feet. And if you don't want it on a trailer, well, we subtract 18% from the cost. So the cost in Toccoa, Georgia is $8,000. And what's great about it is that you can warm them up with two bodies and a candle. And and the walls for Alaska, we have them at R-rated 40, and for the roof, R-60. Also, they are Class 1 fire resistant, meaning that if you go to our website and look at the video, you cannot catch the thing on fire. So they are cheaper to insure. And most important, they appreciate like homes.
Interesting. And for those of us who don't know what R values are, can you compare, what's an average home here in Juneau probably have R values of?
Not much. imagine six hefty inches between you and the elements of this beautiful envelope that keeps you warm. Or cool, for that matter, if it's summer.
Sure, and this the insulation is made out of soy foam.
Yes.
Is that right?
Water based. That's what you can bite into it. It's non toxic, but what's also important is that it doesn't have any food value for mice or termites, so pests won't nest on it. And the exterior, it's sheeted with what has become the national standard, which is weatherized, water-resistant, 7/16 Advantech system, which is the national standard now. You don't need to envelope the outside with the custom things that you see, those unsightly plastics.
Sounds like a win-win. Is there any flip side to these homes?
Not that I didn't get to it sooner. Absolutely. We're very excited to be here. We're open for business. We have opportunities for architects, for contractors. And I participated in different meetings with the city of Juneau and trying to revitalize the second floor of the downtown buildings that nobody's living there. And we came up with a potential solution of, instead of disturbing the buildings that might have asbestos, we can put panels, built in the panels. Now, the other wonderful thing about Cocoon Homes is that you don't need a crane or a forklift to handle the panels. You only need two people, a drill, and you can erect a 1,200-square-foot home in a couple of days.
Wow.
So that's savings in labor that you can put into beautiful finish and beautiful custom fixtures. Or, you know, we thought that young people with a student loan and the car payment, they don't need a mortgage. So you can be mortgage free for $8,000. And if you want something bigger than 147 square feet, well, maybe you should either get a loan because you can get your house ready at your own convenience, you know, in the interior.
Sort of modular.
Yes, exactly.
Very interesting. If somebody wants to learn more about this or meet you, how should they do that?
Well, you can call me at 214-334-3351 or go to Cocoon Homes, all case, K-O-K-O-O-N, homes.com. Or I got the domain of Energy Efficient Homes of Alaska. So all of those are connected.
Okay. Or they can come and sign up for the Innovation Summit and see you speak at 3 p.m. tomorrow.
That's true. Among all their peers, it's going to be simultaneous. And because I went in after a cancellation, I'm not on the billboard or the agenda, but I'm there.
Oh, it sounds very interesting, and it sounds like you're very passionate about it as well.
Well, I'm as passionate as me wanting to be here in Alaska with my kind of people, that it's all about efficiency, innovation, so happy to be here.
And how about you? Are you going to have one of these homes for yourself someday?
Absolutely, yes. I'm going to get the biggest and the baddest, and I'm not just going to have one, I'm going to have several.
All right, Cecilia Rendon, she's part of High Energy Efficiency Homes of Alaska and Cocoon. Can you give us your contact information once more, please?
Yes, my telephone is 214-334-3351.
Okay. And what was the website again?
All case, cocoonhomes.com.
Okay. Cecilia, is there anything we're missing? Anything else you'd like to add?
Go to the website and look at the video of all the happy people that have these homes and how come we earned the class one fire resistance with the blowtorch. That's fascinating. There is no other home that can do that.
All right. Thanks, Cecilia.
Thank you. My pleasure, Scott.
A home, even when it's dark, even when the grass is overgrown in the yard, even when the dog is too old to bark, and when you're sitting at the table trying not to start. A house is a home, even when we've all been gone, even when you're there alone. There's ghosts, even when you gotta run from the ones who love you most. Screen doors, broken paints peeling from the wood. Locals whisper when they're gonna leave the neighborhood. A house is a home, even when we're up and gone, even when you're there alone. Try
start anew. Dear house, tis a home, even when we've up and gone, even when you're there alone.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, February 8th, 2016. It's 30 minutes after the hour.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 8th of February, 2016. It's the birthday of the poet Elizabeth Bishop, born in Worcester, Massachusetts, 1911. Went to Vassar, wrote poetry there, and from her mentor, the poet Marianne Moore, she learned that she could write poems that were not about big ideas like love or death, but just about looking at objects. It's the birthday of John Grisham, born Jonesboro, Arkansas, 1955. He was a successful lawyer. He set out to write a novel about one of his court cases. It was called A Time to Kill. It came out in 1989, did not do well. John Grisham then read an article in Writer's Digest magazine about the rules of suspense, and he used that formula to write a thriller about a law student who realizes the firm that he works for is connected to the mafia. And that was The Firm, a huge bestseller in 1991. Kate Chopin, born in St. Louis, 1850, on this day. She came from a successful family. She was a young socialite, a Southern belle. She got married, had six children. She was a devoted wife and mother. But then her husband died, and then her mother died, and Kate Chopin was depressed. Her doctor encouraged her to write because she was a good letter writer. And so over a period of about 15 years, Kate Chopin wrote almost 100 short stories and two novels, At Fault and The Awakening, in 1899. It was The Awakening that caused a controversy at the time, a story of a woman who gives up being a wife and mother, has an affair, and walks into the sea, perhaps a suicide. It was heavily censored and criticized at the time, now considered an important work by an early feminist author, The Awakening. And it's the birthday of Neil Cassady, born in Salt Lake City, 1926. A con man in and out of jail, came to New York City, met Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, who idolized him. To them, Neil Cassady embodied everything that they embraced in theory. Neil Cassady was the inspiration for the character Dean Moriarty, the hero of Jack Kerouac's On the Road. Allen Ginsberg wrote about him, and Neil Cassady appears in the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test by Tom Wolfe as a friend of Ken Kesey's. Here's a poem for today by Dorian Laux, On the Back Porch. The cat calls for her dinner. On the porch I bend and pour brown soy stars into her bowl, stroke her dark fur. It's not quite night, pinpricks of light in the eastern sky. Above my neighbor's roof, a transparent moon, a pink rag of cloud. Inside my house are those who love me. My daughter dusts biscuit dough, and there's a man who will lift my hair in his hands, brush it until it throws sparks. Everything is just as I've left it. Dinner simmers on the stove. Glass bowls wait to be filled with gold broth, sprigs of parsley on the cutting board. I want to smell this rich soup, the air around me going dark as stars press their simple shapes into the sky. I want to stand on the back porch while the world tilts toward sleep until what I love misses me and calls me in. A poem, On the Back Porch, by Dorian Laux, from her collection Awake, published by Eastern Washington University Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by LegalZoom, providing legal help to Americans with online services, customer support, and independent legal advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Here's some facts about the New Hampshire primary. It turns 100 years old this year.
There's a law that requires it to be the first primary in the nation.
Richard Nixon holds the record for the most New Hampshire primaries won.
Okay, that's three.
So what news will be made this year? I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Join us Tuesday, February 9th for live coverage of the New Hampshire primary from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on KTOO News, you know.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, February 8th, 2016. It's about 35 minutes past the hour. Scott Burton, your host, and I've been joined in the studio now by Sea Alaska Heritage Institute trustee Patrick Anderson. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Well, pleasure to be here, Scott.
It's nice to have you. And also to his left is Dr. Vincent Felitti. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you both here. Dr. Felitti, tomorrow you will be presenting in the Klan House at the Walter Soboloff Building from 12 to 1. Is that correct?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about what you're going to be talking about.
The Adverse Childhood Experiences, or ACE, study. A major piece of American medical research that analyzes the way in which 10 categories of adverse childhood experience, common but generally unrecognized, play out a half century later in adult life in terms of well-being, emotional state, social function, biomedical disease, and premature death.
Yeah, interesting. I read this part of your description. Childhood drama that can manifest into organic disease, like you just said.
Yes. I mean, at every turn, we ran into something unexpected or of vastly greater magnitude than we had ever anticipated.
What might be an example of childhood trauma on the lower end, on the lower scale, minor trauma, if you will?
Well, we studied 10 categories, and the reason we selected these 10 was because of their prevalence in a major obesity program that we were operating. We are using a relatively new technology, supplemented absolute fasting, which allows one to reduce a person's weight by about 300 pounds in 1 year, non-surgically. I mean, this sounds incredible, but it's, you know, there's no question about this. And we, of course, thought, you know, my God, we really must know what we're doing. Look at the results, and we've got this problem licked. And then our patients convinced us that we had no idea what we were doing, but merely were in possession of a powerful technology. And they did that by fleeing their own success. Either leaving the program quickly, and the dropouts were people who were successfully losing weight, or by losing it, regaining it all quickly, or by losing it and becoming panic-stricken, severely depressed, occasionally suicidal, etc. And slowly we came to see, first, that what we had perceived as the problem, major obesity, was in fact merely a symptom of a much more distant and an unrecognized problem, commonly various forms of major childhood abuse. So ultimately the question became, are these things that we are seeing so frequently and so heavily in the weight program at all prevalent in the general population? And if so, how do they play out? And that was really the basis for the ACE study, to answer that seemingly simple question. The 10 categories that we selected, simply because of their prevalence in the weight program, were three of abuse, contact sexual abuse, which is remarkably common but remarkably unrecognized. Major emotional abuse, basically severe and recurrent humiliation, and heavy-duty physical abuse. I'm not talking spanking, I'm talking serious beating with fists, sticks, other objects. Two categories of neglect, emotional neglect, physical neglect, and five categories of major household dysfunction. Growing up in a home where mother was treated violently, growing up in a home where one of the members of your household was mentally ill, chronically depressed, suicidal, or in the state hospital, growing up without both biological parents, growing up in a home where one of the members of your household was an alcoholic or a drug user, and growing up in a home where one of the members of your household was imprisoned during your childhood. So those were the 10 categories. Greatly to our surprise, they were essentially co-equal in terms of destructiveness. Certainly would not have anticipated that. In addition, they were remarkably common. For instance, in a clearly middle-class population of 17,337 middle-aged, middle-class Americans, 74% of whom had been to college, 28% of the women and 16% of the men acknowledged a history of childhood sexual abuse. Usually for the first time, they were telling us this. So we quickly came to see that what one can learn by routine inquiry, you know, assuming it's capably done, was of extraordinary significance. And the way these 10 categories played out roughly a half century later, because the average age participant was 57, the way they played out a half century later was striking in terms of emotional well-being, chronic depression, suicide, etc., in terms of social function or malfunction, imprisonment, etc., biomedical disease, cancer, bone fractures, liver disease, etc., and premature death was, again, really striking. For instance, a person who had experienced any six of the 10 categories, and that was certainly not rare, wasn't the norm, but it wasn't rare, had a life expectancy essentially 20 years shorter, 19.7 precisely years shorter than a person who had experienced none of the six. And the question, of course, is, well, how does that, you know, what are the linking mechanisms that take you from life experience as a child to biomedical disease as an adult?
Mr. Anderson?
You know, Scott, my introduction to the ACE study came from a colleague. And as happens with many other individuals, I started reading it and I said, wow, in large part because I had left the active practice of law about 6-8 years earlier after the death of one of my sisters at age 44. Her second year of massive lung infections. They put her in a coma for two straight summers. The second summer, she didn't survive. My mother, two of my sisters, myself, her husband, a number of nieces, nephews, and children sat and watched her die. If you're not a physician, you're sitting watching someone that you love die. It's life-changing. I left the practice of law and wanted to go into something that might make a little bit of a difference in terms of individuals who were suffering. But it took me 5 years after I made that decision to find the ACE study. I read everything I could find, and as I describe it, I had a digital dictionary next to me because I'm not trained as a physician or a neuroscientist. But I looked up words, I looked at the research, and I said, this is really impacting Native people. I recognize that the population that Dr. Felitti studied was pretty much a privileged population, and that's ultimately what I became. But as I motioned to you when Dr. Felitti was talking about six or more, my sister had at least six, because that's what I had, and she may have had seven. I was not a victim of contact sexual abuse, but I don't know if my sisters were. Today in the state of Alaska, we have some data that indicates that Alaska Natives have four adverse childhood experiences at a rate almost double that of the non-Native population. It impacts the prison population. It impacts dropout rates, promiscuity, sexually transmitted diseases, teen pregnancy, drug use, alcohol abuse, domestic violence. It's pervasive. What I refer to it is as a root cause of a huge number of dysfunctions, both in health and behaviors. But interestingly enough, people look at me and say, well, how come you were successful? Graduated from college, graduated law school, practiced law. And I tell them, your brain is fascinating, that when it finds something that makes you feel good, it wants more of it, whether it's alcohol or praise. When you look at a lot of these individuals who are child actors, child musicians, they deconstruct at age 18 because all of a sudden they're not cute and cuddly anymore. They're fair game for the paparazzi and the rags, and they can't handle it. Plus, they have this huge amount of money that allows them to pay for whatever it is that makes them feel better. It resonated with me. It continues to resonate with me 8 years later. And the reason that I asked Dr. Felitti to come to Alaska is that we need to let the governor know, the legislators know, policymakers understand that the cost of not addressing childhood trauma is, in Alaska, I would venture to guess, $2 to $3 billion.
Wow. Dr. Felitti, who do you think would benefit from coming to your presentation tomorrow?
I think anyone in the general population, if you are referring to who might be able to do the most with that information on a population-wide basis, certainly people in the legislature. I spoke recently in Little Rock, Arkansas, and I was surprised that the current governor and a former governor were in the audience. They were there because they had heard about the massive dollar savings in medical care that we were able to illustrate in a 130,000 patient sample, where we looked into this carefully. There are not many 130,000 patient samples for anything. And, the saving that we measured was a 35% reduction in doctor office visits over a one-year period subsequent to introducing this material into the general medical patient history. In other words, made routine inquiry of every patient in this 130,000 people as to whether they had experienced any of these life experiences as children, and then inquired, well, can you tell me how that's affected you later in your life? And the stories were extraordinary.
And I suspect, Mr. Anderson, that people like you who have received childhood trauma would also probably benefit from this.
Definitely. One of the understandings I came to is that if you have knowledge that what happened to you impacted you as an adult and it can impact your health, it no longer becomes an explanation of, you know, he's just a bad seed. They're from the wrong side of the railroad tracks. They're bad kids. They're bad adults. They grew up in a bad family. It then becomes, something that happened to you for which you were not responsible, but with that knowledge you can begin to assume responsibility for your own healing and begin to understand that what your brain is doing to you when it dumps chemicals into your body leads to these feelings. I hear it described all of the time. Sometimes you want to strangle someone. Sometimes you just lash out. It's all perfectly understandable once you begin studying the brain, but most people don't do that. But the knowledge itself, I'm not a bad seed. I'm not from the wrong side. I'm a good person. It's just things happen to me. Let me take responsibility for my life. Some people need more than that. I don't want to say that's the total solution, but it is the start, and I think that's what Dr. Felitti is saying with the 130,000 patient sample.
It sounds akin to the power of a diagnosis, really.
Certainly so, and in that regard, it's important to recognize that in all of medicine, there are only three sources of diagnostic information: patient history, physical examination, and laboratory studies. If you ask patients, and I have literally done this of 10,000 by questionnaire some years ago, patients overwhelmingly assume the diagnosis comes out of a lab test. Oh, I want all the lab tests, doctor. I want all the blood tests. Which of the 6,427 do you really mean? If you speak with experienced physicians, they'll tell you that about 80% of the time diagnosis comes out of patient history. The problem with that is that it is time-consuming, fraught with interpersonal difficulties, etc. And we found in the course of doing this work that that kind of information is best obtained by an inert mechanism initially. In our experience, a well-devised 10-page medical history questionnaire filled out at home, not on some clipboard in the doctor's waiting room, etc., and then pursued in the examining room. And that's a very big idea.
This is all very fascinating. And you will be presenting tomorrow, Tuesday, the 9th, from 12 to 1 in the Klein House at the Walter Soboloff building. I'm sure you'll be recapping many of the things that we spoke about today. And what else can folks expect?
Let me mention two ideas that I think people will quickly understand. One, we saw that there's a very big public health paradox, that many of the things that we see as public health problems are that, in the sense that they're socially costly, annoying, etc. But more importantly, they are often unrecognized solutions on an individual basis, or attempted solutions on an individual basis to problems that we know nothing about. For instance, street drugs, crystal meth. Everybody has heard crystal, you know, bad stuff, people die of it, etc. Virtually no one knows that the first successful prescription antidepressant introduced for sale in the United States in 1940 was methamphetamine, the very same chemical which in impure form and unknown dose is known as crystal meth. But, can't you die from that? Yeah, you can die from taking 30 aspirin tablets at once. You know, you triple your digitalis dose, you'd be dead in a week. So the issues in terms of dosage and the use of these materials are critically important. So no one is using crystal meth to die. People are using crystal meth to try to feel better. Unfortunately, it's extremely dangerous if you don't know anything about dosage. Another general example. When you look at a house burning down, what you see in a house fire, the most obvious thing is the smoke billowing out. You know, and most of us have heard that you can die from smoke inhalation. So maybe we better get that smoke treated and bring big fans to blow the smoke away. Except the house burns down faster. And pretty soon homeowners flee the treatment. much as people flee treatment for drug addiction and other forms of addiction. So it's important to understand that what is the most manifest symptom is simply that and not the causal issue that really needs to be identified and treated.
Okay, gentlemen, we have about a minute left. Some closing thoughts, Mr. Anderson?
Yes, Scott. Representative Garen Tarr filed a concurrent resolution, House Concurrent Resolution Number 1, that is asking the legislature and the governor to consider adverse childhood experiences and childhood trauma in state policy areas like corrections, education, juvenile justice, children's services. And I would encourage any of your listeners to look up House Concurrent Resolution 21, and if they feel inclined to send a letter of support or public opinion message. Dr. Felitti will be talking to the governor on Wednesday. We did have a House Hess hearing that was unfortunately canceled, so we won't be able to present that information to the legislature directly. But this is an area that I believe people should support and become interested in. We have a lot of healing to do in my native community, but what Dr. Felitti's research indicated, it's everywhere.
Okay. Sir, any last thoughts?
I think what we have said thus far, the two of us, is a good index of what we discovered and the huge potential it has if this is put into action. If some move is made by the legislature in Alaska to foster that, that would be of great importance. The first state to do that was Vermont, I believe, about 2 years ago, and there have been four more states since then. So it may be a very promising beginning.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Vincent Felitti and also Sea Alaska Heritage Institute Trustee Patrick Anderson, thank you for your time. The presentation is tomorrow, Tuesday, from 12 to 1 in the Walter Soboloff building in the Klan House. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to A Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow we'll learn about the Great Backyard Bird Count with guest Brenda Wright. We'll get a preview of this Thursday's Tiny Post Office Concert featuring Emmett Williams of Sitka and Goldwing from Juno. We'll get the details about this Wednesday night's Mudrooms event. We'll talk to members of the Zach Gordon Youth Center's writing team in the recent district-wide Battle of the Books competition. Looking at the weather, the forecast for tonight calls for rain, lows around 37, and tomorrow rain likely, mainly in the morning, highs around 43. Thanks for tuning in to A Juno Afternoon.